Judge O'Connor, someone that is well known here and, you know, truly needs no introduction. So when I was thinking about what to say, I went ahead and emailed all his law clerks and asked them, what is an interesting fact about Judge O'Connor that no one else would know? And I got a lot of very weird responses, everything from hand gestures he uses to weird tics he may have. But the only one I felt safe enough to actually publicly talk about from all the very interesting things his clerks had to say about him was that Judge O'Connor goes to only two restaurants every single day for lunch. He goes to what I've been told is a very mediocre Mexican restaurant and a somewhat decent German restaurant. And I thought that hearing that this man, who's been a judge for almost 20 years now, goes to the same two restaurants every single day is a perfect encapsulation of what makes him such a great judge. Once he figures out the right answer, he is never going to change. He's never going to alter. He doesn't want to hear from you. He's going to keep going back there over and over and over again because he knows what he likes and what he knows what is right. So with that, Judge O'Connor.
All right, thank you.
The German restaurant's actually a steakhouse, and I get grilled chicken there. And the Mexican food restaurant my wife refuses to come to because she really dislikes it. But I like it, and so. There's a pizza place I go to as well, so there's really three. But thank you, Pri, for that. And I want to thank Lisa, Hannah, and Abby as well as Pri and others who helped put this panel together. It's a very important topic. The title of the panel is The Consequences of Disruption, and it is a very timely subject. Many of you recall the Stanford Law School scandal where Judge Duncan was publicly shouted down by student protesters. Professor Josh Blackman experienced similar treatment not too long ago at a New York law school. And these are just two of many examples. Thank you. We will hear from our esteemed panelists on their views of what I believe is a very disturbing trend, disrupting speakers invited to campus venues and separately attempting to place off limits any discussion of any perceived topics that are deemed unacceptable. This is particularly worrisome when it appears that our country's universities and law schools condone it. But the sentiment also appears to have spread elsewhere in the legal industry, whether in-house, at large law firms, or within bar associations. And this is alarming, I think, because throughout our history, lawyers have worked to preserve, protect, and defend the rule of law in order to ensure justice for all. The rule of law depends on the free exchange of ideas and equal representations. But the more our culture moves away from this ideal of free speech, there is a risk that our legal system will not be able to protect the rule of law. The legal industry, especially the very places tasked with training those who will enter it, needs to demonstrate that it values these concepts and that these concepts are worth fighting for. How else will we pass on the importance of protecting our fundamental rights to our future generations? Thankfully, those who truly understand this danger are speaking out, but far too many remain fearful. And so what should we do about it? Hopefully we'll hear about that from a varied perspective here today. We have very distinguished panelists on this panel, all of whom have unique connections to the legal industry. And we'll hear from them in a minute. Like the last panel, I will introduce our panelists and then they will take some time to give their views on the subject, and then we'll follow up with perhaps some questions back and forth, and then if we have time to take questions from anyone who has them in the audience. And so let me begin by introducing our panelists, and I'll just move down, beginning with the dean, and move on down to my left. Our first panelist is Dean Robert Adier, or as his students know him, is Dean Bobby, probably one of the only law school deans in Texas, if not further, who is on essentially on a first name basis with his student body, a real testament to the dean. Dean Bobby received his undergraduate degree from Princeton and his law degree from Yale Law School. He has been a professor at Columbia Law School, Georgetown Law School, and Emory Law School, where at Emory Law School, the dean was the vice dean, and he served there before his current appointment as dean of the Texas A&M University Law School in Fort Worth. Before entering academia, Dean Adie clerked for Judge James Browning on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and worked in the U.S. Department of Justice. Next, we have Justice Jimmy Blacklock. Justice Blacklock has been a member of the Texas Supreme Court since 2018. Before that, he served as Governor Abbott's general counsel and in the Attorney General's office under General Abbott. He has worked in private practice in Houston and did a stint in the George W. Bush administration in Austin, Texas. Justice Blacklock clerked for Judge Jerry Smith on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals after completing his undergraduate studies at UT Austin and receiving his law degree at the Yale Law School. And a source in this room, who will remain nameless, has disclosed, or perhaps we should call it a whistleblower, has disclosed that he uses a flip phone. So I'm very impressed by that. The only two people I know who do that are Justice Blacklock and Jerry Jones.
We have the evidence.
And my only thinking on that, given that I thought it was Jerry Jones who was the only person who had that before, is that you figured the FBI had moved so far beyond tracking, with modern technology, tracking iPhones and Samsungs, that they forgot how to track people on flip phones, and so it's a defensive mechanism. Next to Justice Blacklock is Mr. Greg Costa. Mr. Costa is a partner at Gibson Dunn. But we all know that until recently, he was Judge Costa, after having spent many years on the federal bench, serving on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and before that, in the Southern District of Texas. It is important to note that while a district judge in the Southern District of Texas, he received, quote, all of the cases filed in the Galveston Division, close quote, otherwise known as the presiding judge of a single division. And while a presiding judge of a single division, he received no complaint from a member of Congress or a law school teacher. And I'm told that following this panel, Judges Kaczmarek, Hendricks, and Tipton plan to meet with him to get any tips from him on presiding in a single division.
Victoria, too, so 2-1 judge.
And no complaints. It's a miracle. Judge Costa received his undergraduate degree from Dartmouth College and is a graduate of the University of Texas Law School. After law school, Judge Costa clerked for Judge William Rehnquist on the U.S. Supreme Court and for Judge Raymond Randolph on the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Next to Judge Costa is Hiram Sasser. Mr. Sasser is well known to us all here. He is the executive general counsel for the First Liberty Institute, where he oversees First Liberty's litigation and media efforts. Mr. Sasser appears with us today fresh off of his role as co-counsel in several Supreme Court victories, including the cases that involved Coach Kennedy, Groff versus DeJoy, and many others. He received his undergraduate degree from Oklahoma State University, where as an alumni of this school, he is the subject every year of a viral OSU college football meme. So be on the lookout this year for a viral meme with the picture of Hiram Sasser flying around the internet. He is also a graduate of the Oklahoma City University School of Law. And last but not least, and perhaps even more important, is Mr. Ammon Smart. He received his BS in accounting from the University of Tennessee and his law degree from the University of Memphis. Mr. Smart has worked in both private practice for a large law firm and in-house for Arthur Andersen and Ernst & Young. He has been with WTW, a British American insurance services provider from 2011 to today. He became WTW's general counsel of North America in January of 2022. Now, why is he most important? Well, many of us all have children who will someday get married, and Mr. Smart after this panel is willing to talk to those of us in those shoes about how to attend and pay for three weddings of your children within 1 year.
Whoa.
And my guess is he'll say be general counsel of WTW's helps to some degree, at least, right? So without further ado, why don't we begin at the same way the panel did a moment ago, and I'll turn it over to Dean Bobby.
So do you want me to turn to the come some of the questions?
Why don't you just make whatever remarks you want? We want to cover these or anything else, okay, and sure. We can follow up.
So let me first begin by thanking Judge O'Connor and the Federal Society for having me here today, and to the conference organizers. It's a real honor and pleasure to be here. I've had the opportunity to attend Federal Society events now for almost 30 years, and probably dating from late in law school and then in starting my academic career to participate in programs. And I really have great admiration for the work it does on exactly this topic that we're talking about today, in terms of encouraging engagement with a breadth of ideas, a broad range of ideas, including those with which we may or may not, on any given day, I should say, agree or disagree. So three things briefly I'll say a couple of words about, and then maybe in Q&A we can elaborate some more. One goes to sort of what I think of as a part of the origin of this phenomenon that we're talking about in the law school context, and that goes to kind of the viewpoints of that are represented in the faculty of our law schools. This is obviously a topic we're all familiar with, and we talk about a great deal in terms of whether we are reflecting the full breadth of political and other views in the composition of the faculty of our law schools. For me, this issue really is a fundamentally important one, because in some sense it seeds or it lays the groundwork or it fertilizes the soil for us to have some of the issues that we are dealing with and that Judge O'Connor described at the outset. I have told my students for many years that fundamentally what they are learning in law school is the art of asking questions, and not just about the arguments with which they disagree, but also about the arguments with which they agree. And further, that if they are the very best lawyers when they graduate, when they go off into practice, their goal should be to be the very best lawyer on every side of the cases in which they're involved. So if they were to walk into the courtroom and the judge says, just to mix it up today, I'm going to have you switch sides, have the attorney switch side. I want my students to still win the case that day, because they have so immersed themselves and so well understand or so deeply engaged with the fundamentals of the arguments against them as they are with the arguments that they are prepared to offer, that they're able to take that position and argue it effectively. And again, I would invoke FedSoc as reflecting in the structure of its programs in law schools as reflecting exactly that, the goal of creating a climate in which students are almost forced, but at least at a minimum encouraged to engage that diversity of views. That is hard to accomplish when it's not the case that the faculty is reflective of that. Now, I want to sort of emphasize in that regard that I don't think of that as a requirement of being able to do that. I had the great privilege of learning a great deal from Robbie George when I was an undergraduate, had multiple classes with him, the seminars with him, so on and so forth. And what I always told people is that he was incredibly effective, that if sitting in his class of, whether it was a class of 20 or a class of 400, if someone offered an uninformed conservative view, he would eat them alive just as quickly, and sometimes more so, as he would if someone offered an uninformed liberal view on whatever question was in front of us. So in that sense, he was an equal opportunity educator. He was interested in making all of us better at what we were doing, at the analytical techniques that education, and this was undergraduate, that he was trying to teach to us. And I think it's possible to do this, but it's hard to do if you rely on the ability of faculty who all share one view to convey that across the board. And so that's why I think it is important that faculties be reflective in broader ways than they are today. And I don't think really, we sometimes have band-aids for that, say, well, there's adjunct faculty or visiting speakers or the like. I do think it's important that higher education and law schools in particular, given what I've just described, that we practice that and we put that into form. So that's kind of a background point. Briefly, kind of on our themes, I'll just say on the specific theme of this disruption phenomenon, I'll just mention two quick points, and then again we can elaborate as we go along. So first, in terms of the behavior that we are, you know, we saw at Stanford, and Josh is here, I think, the experienced as well. The I think in part this can be traced to, in some ways, the consumer mindset that is now pretty pervasive in higher education. We talk all the time about what it is that the consumers, what it is that the consumers of our product want, the and how we can give that to them more effectively. I don't think there's anything wrong with that per se. I think we should be attentive to that, and I think that can have a whole range of salutary benefits and effects. That said, there's a danger in it that you can collapse into the notion that whatever they want, they get, right? The as opposed to our job is to educate and to train and refine and teach the skills of being being professionals. The and that's really where, for me, I think when I think about these disruptions, fundamentally, I think of them as exercises in lack of professionalism. That fundamentally, if you think about what our profession looks like, and I know that when I've had occasion to talk to students, whether at my own law school or elsewhere, about this issue, most commonly I frame it in that way. Imagine in a courtroom, imagine in a negotiation, imagine in any other legal setting, if the model was, I'm going to say my part, and then I'm going to prevent you from saying yours. None of us would tolerate that. I mean, it would be, it's not even a, you know, well, what was the context? There would be no context in which you find it tolerable. So we can ascribe some of this to youthful indiscretion and say students are still learning. And I think that is important. We should acknowledge that the students we're talking about are still students, but we are training them to be professionals. I think the more we emphasize that, the more we set that as the expectation, the more we're able to navigate. Let me stop there, I think, and then I can say more in Q&A later.
Justice Blackmun.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here with all of you guys. I was a student at Yale Law School from 2002 to 2005. And you know, one of the things that I think we hear a lot when people comment on these sorts of cultural trends, and particularly when these sorts of cultural trends start to get, you know, media attention and kind of traction on the right, is people will say, you know, you're exaggerating this, this isn't really happening the way you think it is, or maybe they'll say, it's sort of always been like this, and now you're just noticing and making a big deal out of it. It was not like this when I was at Yale Law School less than 20 years ago. Not at all. This is a new development, a new phenomenon. It's real. And it's very, very different from how I experienced law school. I said and did all kinds of things in the classrooms and the hallways of Yale Law School that I think might get me expelled if I were a student there today. And I'm really not joking. And I said those things openly and freely and without any concern about the consequences. And then we went and had a beer. Played softball, or you know, did the things we did outside of class, and I still keep in touch with many, you know, very liberal classmates from law school who I respect, and they respect me, and we had all kinds of interesting conversations about politics and about very controversial aspects of politics and philosophy and history and all these questions, and it was all okay. And this was not that long ago. And I've had clerks from various law schools, Yale among them, who tell me a very disheartening story about their experience and the pressure that they feel to conform to a certain way of talking and thinking, and the difficulty that they encounter when they try to, you know, express a view that is a, you know, minority view at their school, and just the overall climate of hostility and tension that I think must surely suppress the free inquiry that the universities are supposed to be standing for. I was supposed to go to Yale Law School. I haven't been since I've been a judge, and I've wanted to go back to my alma mater and give a talk. I was scheduled to do it in 2020, and then there was an incident at a lab in China, and that didn't happen.
That's where it started.
And now you won't be able to go to Yale in 2023.
I wasn't able to go, and I have not been back since. But my only reservation about going in the future would not be that this would, you know, what happened to Judge Duncan would happen to me. It would actually be that it wouldn't happen to me. if what you have to say is, you know, insufficiently interesting, or if you just sort of don't matter, then you know they're probably not going to show up and do to you what they did to Judge Duncan. So, if you are concerned that will happen to you, or if it has happened to you, remember the words of my namesake from the Bible. Consider it pure joy when you face trials of various kinds. And if you encounter this sort of shouting down or aggressive hostility to your ideas, that is a trial from which you should take joy.
Thank you. Judge Costa.
Thank you. Well, thanks first for inviting me. And it's good to see a lot of friends here, including at least three of my former colleagues on the circuit who are here. So, you know, if we have time for questions, I hope they'll question, challenge me. It'll feel just like old times, but it's great to see them. Look, I think, you know, any thinking person would be troubled by, you know, what happened to my former colleague and friend, Judge Duncan, and what you hear about at a lot of law schools. I do think it is a more pronounced problem at elite law schools and at law schools in certain parts of the country. I think there are plenty of law schools in Texas where I've visited where I don't get the sense, you know, Baylor, for example, I don't get the sense that's as prevalent there. I don't get the sense it's as prevalent at either of the law schools here in Houston. But certainly it's a big problem on a number of law school campuses. I think it really is, as people have alluded to, I think it really is a generational problem. I think even, you know, on the liberal side of things, you know, you see liberal judges still protecting hate speech, recognizing those First Amendment freedoms. So I think this is largely a generational change on the left. Why is it happening? I think there's two broader societal trends this is really a manifestation of. One is, I think our education system and the way we raise children generally is just very soft in society. And so I think, yes, so these students are offended when someone disagrees with them on a high profile public issue. But that's just part of, they're offended whenever they encounter anything difficult or uncomfortable. You know, when I would hire law clerks, I like to hire them right out of law school. Judge Smith was with me on that, fighting the trend of these people who clerk when they're, you know, 35, 10 years out of law school. But I liked hiring people who had worked between college and law school. And one of the reasons was, they've been out of this education world. They'd had experience in the real world, because for people who've just gone straight through school, you know, with great inflation these days, with schools not wanting, I think you said, the consumer model of education we now have, people who've just been in the education world haven't been criticized, haven't had to, and so I'd give them an opinion, their first opinion with edits all over it. And for some of them, it was like the most criticism they'd ever received in 25 years of existence. And so some of them handled that well. Some didn't, but I really do think we're, you know, the way, you know, the culture of giving everyone a trophy, it's just students these days aren't conditioned to facing difficulties. I also think our society is getting more segmented. You know, kids in New York City are growing up only hearing one set of views. Kids in rural Texas are growing up only hearing one set of views. So then they get to college, they get to law school. My God, people think different than me. This is outrageous. How can they think that? And there's this great offense, and they're just not ready for that. So I think that is part of it. The other thing is, I think there's an obsession, again, especially generationally, with how people speak or think versus how they actually act. What I mean, you know, I always wonder when I read these stories about your alma mater, Yale Law School, these crazy things that happen there. I always think, you know, aren't there soup kitchens in New Haven? In other words, because these students who obviously have very strongly held progressive views, which, great, I respect anyone who has strongly held views, why don't they go do something consistent with their value in action, in conduct, instead of just, I guess, you know, the word is virtue signaling, like, oh, don't we feel good because we shouted someone down or we protested? I mean, actually do something through your deeds that are valuable for society. But I think it's just an obsession now with, people are judged on, you know, do they use the right term? Do they use the right word for this or that? And we've moved away from judging people on their deeds. And I think part of that, if you judge people on their deeds and think of people's virtue as being based on how they conduct themselves, it's easier to say, okay, well, she may not see the world the same way I do, but you know what? She's a good mother. She does a lot of charitable works. She's an impressive person in her field. I think there's more commonality when you see that despite our views, a lot of people we can respect how they're conducting their lives and how they, through their actions. So I do think it's a, to me, the fact that it's a part of these broader trends is more troubling. But I do think it's definitely something that's plaguing many law schools. And I think we'll talk later. I haven't yet quite seen it manifest itself this strongly in the world of practice, but that may be coming. And I think that's something we're going to talk about on this panel. So,
thank you, Judge Costa. Mr. Sasson.
Well, I thought this was a panel about how to be a disruptor. And that's why I thought Free called me for this. He's trying to get vengeance on me. He claims that I almost got him harmed in some way by a tornado on a back road in Mississippi. But, I was born and raised in Oklahoma, which means I'm an amateur meteorologist. And with, the iPhone, which I have an iPhone, Jimmy, it's all right. It has a radar thing, and I could tell that we were going to miss that tornado by at least 5 miles. So Pre claims he saw it, but you'll have to ask him about all that. But anyway, one of the things that I found fascinating is that, lots of things I find fascinating, but one of them is that, First Liberty, where I work, we do religious liberty cases. Some of those religious liberty cases touch upon hot button issues that intersect with abortion or gay rights. I've been really surprised that we're not on the hate list. That's kind of been the new thing now, which is, putting some of these groups that do religious liberty work, the Southern Poverty Law Center puts them on a hate list. And then once you're on a hate list, well, you're a hater. And if you're a hater, then everyone can hate you and feel really good about it. And it makes everybody feel warm at night knowing they hate the haters, right? And so I had an event where I was at Texas A&M Law School speaking, and it was Ryan Bangard and I were on the panel, and there was sort of this protest that happened. I guess it was like the protest happened afterwards. It's like they didn't get the memo we were coming, and so they did a little protest afterwards. And I was a little jealous because the protesting letter that was sent to, to the dean over here mentioned mostly Ryan Banger. And then I got like this little footnote there at the end.
And come back. Well, whatever.
I need to get back there. It reminds me of being at the University of Alabama, and I'm debating with Kyle Hawkins about qualified immunity, and in busts in this one lone protester. It handed out the flyers and everything else. I'm like, finally, someone's gonna break up the monotony of this thing. And it's gonna be really cool. And so I'm waiting to hear, I'm a bad guy or whatever. And she started complaining about Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. Your firm.
There you go.
Apparently, there, Judge Costa, your firm is burning down the rainforest in Brazil or something. And so I was like, no. What about me? I'm Hiram Sasser at First Liberty. She's like, I've never heard of you. So, at least when I went to the University of Michigan, I had about 150 protesters. I was really excited about that. But I was there to talk about the Establishment Clause, and I was like, I didn't realize that engendered like that level of excitement. But of course, it was because, probably our Klein case, the cake baker case and that sort of stuff is why they were there. And so I decided I was just going to start off with talking about representing the Falun Gong in the past, the Islamic Association of Collin County, and various Jewish synagogues, and they all started looking around trying to figure out if they'd gone to the right room. and then I grabbed the FedSoc kids there. I shouldn't say kids, sorry guys, kids, whatever. The FedSoc folks, adults. See, I'm gonna get canceled now. they had like all the little snacks and stuff like that. So they had the Oreos. And so I was taking the Oreos around, you know, and offering Oreos while I got into the meat of my talk, kind of like, you know, Phil Donahue used to do, you know, with the microphone. No one laughed at that because no one's old enough to remember Phil Donahue. Yeah, yeah. Okay. But anyway, and so they really didn't know what to do with all that stuff. Here's the thing on the disruption deal is that there is a concerted effort, and it's not just in the little protests or whatever that happened. There's really a desire to eliminate competition in the realm of ideas. And it's not about I want to be able to come to the right solution or whatever. It's literally, I don't want there to be any competition of the ideas anymore. The ideas of the left are going to win because there's no one else is going to show up on the field. And if they do show up on the field, we're going to drill them and we're going to destroy them. And I think Ryan Newman said it best, you know, they're not going to take you out to the guillotine. You know, it's not going to be that clean and up front. They're just going to, you know, because I understand how to deal with that, right? You want to stab me in the chest, that's fine. We can fight it out. But no, they're gonna take away your job. They're gonna take away your livelihood. They're gonna take away your ability to live in polite society. If you don't believe me, then I'll ask you this to take the challenge. And this is the challenge that I gave a Washington Post reporter who refused to take my challenge. I said, I want you to put down on Twitter right now that you believe in the traditional definition of marriage as a man and a woman. Leave it, let that thing hang there for about 2 hours. Then you can tweet out, I was just kidding. I was just trying to prove this moron wrong and see nothing bad ever happened to me. And he said, well, I won't do it. I said, why won't you do it? What? Just do it. You tell everybody it was just a joke. Why won't you do it? And it was quiet, and I said, you won't do it because you know that once you do it, you're dead. You're dead, and that's it. And so, you know, one of our models, one of the ways we do our cases, the primary way we do our cases at First Liberty is we partner with basically all of you, and many of you have done cases with you over the years. And, you know, you guys take risks to participate with us. And that's a two-way street. One is I understand that, which is why I work, you know, and at First Liberty, we work terribly hard to make sure that the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN are going to say nice things about our case, or as nice as we can get them. But secondly, I know that at the firm, it's tough, right, to take on some of these cases and some of these matters, yet you do it anyway, which I find absolutely fascinating that anybody does this. But I have cases that I can't get firms to be able to work with. No one is going to be able to represent Professor Varkey for being fired from a college in San Antonio because as a biology professor, he said there were two genders. Ooh, wow. but that's blasphemy. He's a heretic and he must be burned at the stake. And anyone who comes to his aid or defense, it's just not going to happen, you know? And so it's a very serious problem. And the question is really, what are we going to do and how do we respond to the problem? Well, there's two ways to respond and everybody can participate in this room. One is that you can take small steps to do things, courageous things. I'm not asking for everybody to stand up and let's go do Professor Varkey's case together. I recognize that at some point you have kids you'd like to send to college and, you know, you have a mortgage payment to make and that sort of thing. But there are little steps and little fights that we can engage in. You don't have to do Pickett's charge. Just pick up a rifle and man a post somewhere doing some cause that you believe in. And do it courageously. And what you'll find is that, well, like I survived. And then we can continue on and go forward. The second thing to do is let's not get in the habit of trying to go tit for tat and cancel the other people. I don't think that that's the best approach. We want to drag them out into the marketplace of ideas, and we want to duke it out over our ideas, shame them for not engaging in the debate, force them to engage in the exchange. And I think that those are really two good tools. So get out there and be courageous in at least some small way. And secondly, is continuously seek the opportunity to debate your opponents. I think it's really, really important. And that's it.
Thank you, Ira. Mr. Ford.
All right. Thank you for having me here today. Can you hear me? Is this working? So Judge O'Connor, I need to start off by saying that my opinions today are my own precisely because I need to keep my job to pay for those three weddings. But when I started to think about this topic, and I want to give the view from in-house counsel, to be quite honest, when you're in-house, a lot of times my practice is very different, I think, from the rest of the panelists. You look up from your desk as you're representing your corporation, and you read these headlines, and you think, what in the world? Because my law school experience, I think, was similar to Justice Blaylock's, where you could speak your mind. There was open debate. And as the conservative in class, I often was that whipping boy who would raise my hand and say, no, I disagree with what you just said. That doesn't make sense. But how does that translate to in-house counsel, and particularly, you know, serving as the general counsel of a multinational corporation? Harkening back to some of the things that were said in the previous panel, corporations exist to make money. And I think, again, my own personal view is that corporations have gotten way too involved with politics. They've gone too woke, when really what they need to do is focus on their core purpose of making money. I'm a capitalist, not because capitalism is perfect, but it's the best thing going. And when corporations lose sight of that, that's when stupid decisions are made. And so obviously if corporations are not making money, they can't employ people. They also can't make charitable contributions, and they certainly can't make political donations. And so I liked what Toby said on the previous panel, is that you need to use business judgment. And so when I look at the types of folks, and particularly seeing law students who are behaving in that way, it's concerning. Because in-house, my clients, it's a multinational corporation, we're in 140 different countries. So we have diversity of thought by definition because we're everywhere. And you simply cannot behave that way and get business done. It wouldn't work. And so you have to be able to be professional, right? After all, law school is a professional education. And so it's concerning when you see students behaving that way. I do hope that a lot of it is youthful indiscretion, and I hope that the academy can sort of perhaps recognize that and utilize it and actually teach that, okay, you've had your youthful indiscretion moment. Now, here's how it really works, particularly in the context of when students are protesting to try to keep corporations who they deem to be evil from having legal representation. That's problematic on a number of levels. But in addition, you know, of course, our judicial system is adversarial. That's how it works, is you have to have opposing views, opposing opinions. Our democracy is deliberative. And so that's why free speech is so important to what we do. And so I found an article. I actually saw this a week ago. It was in Forbes, titled "The State of Campus Speech, Troubling but Not Hopeless." And I wanted to... He shared some statistics that I thought were interesting. He said 44% of students say that a speaker who believes that transgender people have a mental disorder definitely shouldn't be allowed to speak on campus. In the case of a speaker who'd argue for making abortion completely illegal, 39% say the same. When the hypothetical speakers were right-leaning, the results looked very different. For a speaker who would repeal the Second Amendment, 9% of students say they definitely shouldn't be allowed on campus. For a speaker who'd assert that America is marked by structural racism and white privilege, 11% of students wouldn't allow them on campus. So in short, when speakers were right-leaning, about 4 in 10 students would keep them off campus, or 40%. And when they were left-leaning, the figure was closer to 10%, which is interesting. Certainly a bias there. But perhaps not hopeless in that at least those students still do recognize something of what speech is. It's just they need to understand that the freedom, the key to that freedom is recognizing the speech of people with whom you actually disagree. And so hopefully the Academy can help us there. But again, back to the sort of the in-house perspective, when I look to hire a law firm or, for that matter, legal talent to come in-house, we first look at their qualifications, you know, and the way we do that is we get resumes, you know, pretty basic stuff. Does your resume fit the position? But obviously, a key part of what we do in that process is we interview people, which I think is very important because you pick up on things like soft skills. Do you get along with people? Are you going to get along with your colleagues? Do you play well with others? But also, judgment is a key thing that I look for when I'm hiring someone. Do you have good judgment? And the way that some of these students behave is concerning because it would suggest that perhaps they don't. And I do believe in redemption. So perhaps if the Academy and the students actually come to their senses, you can probe for things like that in the context of an interview. But anyone who believes that the way to win a debate is by silencing your opponent lacks judgment, especially a law student, because that's not how our system works. It can't work that way. So I'll leave it with that.
Well, thank you, and very well put. So why don't we start with our full-time educator on the panel, I think Bobby, and you and I both were at the Trolt Banquet this year when Judge Ho made his remarks. And in talking about this concept, he said that from his view that he believed part of the problem was the lack of intellectual diversity at the law schools. It's one thing maybe to have some speakers come in or have some adjunct professors. You have Judge Pittman, Judge Starr on your campus, but there's no real people on law school faculties writ large who are conservative. Even our flagship school has lost Professor Gralia, and even those who didn't go to the University of Texas knew about him for decades. And so what is your take on that? Do you believe that's a problem? Do you believe bringing in a couple of FedSoc speakers or hosting a conference or having an adjunct professor suffices, or does there need to be more intellectual diversity among the tenured permanent faculty? And is it hard to get them?
Great, great. So, you know, obviously this is, again, as I mentioned earlier, kind of a longstanding conversation about this phenomenon and lots of theories of origin and genesis and the like. So, but I'm a practical guy running a law school. And so, as I shared earlier, I do think, again, it is hard to effectively instill, effectively and sustainably, maybe I should say, instill that what we are all describing from our perspective as lawyers and folks who've been in the world of practice, the essential skill of being able to engage in argument even with those with whom you disagree. Now, just the very phrasing of that, that's literally what we do. I mean, it's not the idea that, you know, how do we get students to do this? If we don't get them to do this, well, then we're all done, right? Because that's literally what lawyers do as a profession. And so I think that is hard to accomplish with that. Again, although I would make the reference that I said earlier, I used the Robbie George example. I don't think I would be nervous in some sense about falling into the trap of the only way that you can effectively understand a liberal argument is from a liberal professor, and the only way you understand a conservative argument is from a conservative professor. I think at its best, what we want is we want to see all faculty effectively training students in that skill. But again, you are more likely to get that result in a sustainable fashion if their faculty is representative. So, and I don't think again, visiting speakers or adjuncts suffice for that. So again, the question is then how do you operationalize that? And so I know that at our law school, we think about this, and obviously within the bounds of we're a public institution, and so we're careful in that regard. And you know, I have a sense that, or we have a sense that we have some, you know, representation across the faculty, but we've tried to make it systematic as well in terms of that. So some of you may know we have a big center on the structural constitution that we are going to be establishing at the law school, including, not exclusively, but including with an eye to creating opportunities for that. You mentioned the, you know, can you find them? I think you can find them. I think that's a little bit of a false thing. And I will say, I like the number of points that were made, not about the, you know, the shouting down thing, because the shouting down thing, truth is, I do think is less common than, you know, what you see online might suggest. the cancellation and the pressure to conform, I totally agree with Justice Blacklock, is a massive problem. And I've shared that with our FedSoc students at A&M, and I've shared it, frankly, with the non-FedSoc students to say that if you had to pick one of the following statements to make, and one of the statements is, I believe that marriage is traditional marriage, should be defined as marriage of a man and a woman, which of these would you worry more about making? And I don't think I've found a student at the law school who didn't agree that it was much more dangerous, for lack of a better word, not to the guillotine, but to the your standing and your career prospects to make the one statement versus the other statement. So what we do about that, especially given that it's a much broader phenomenon, right? We do it with movie stars and with actors and with politicians and others as well. But again, I like the point that was made at the end that especially for lawyers and hence then especially for students, we have to find a solution to that because there's no way we can sustain what our profession, how our profession functions if it's the case that saying something that I disagree with is problematic.
And so you think your faculty is representative? Do you have any faculty members here?
No, or do they come to I don't think our faculty is representative.
Intellectually diverse, I guess.
No, I know what you meant.
I was saying they may be representative, but are they intellectually diverse?
I think that we are above. I mean, you know, there's Deci data on this. So when I look at the data that we can find, we're above average, but probably still below where we should be in that regard. And again, I think that's why it needs to be a priority to focus on it. Although again, with the caveat of, I don't want to rely on, you know, if you're a conservative student, you will get your fix in these three classes with these professors. And if you're a liberal student, my charge to every one of my faculty members would be thinking, now, do they do that on any given day? You know, probably depends. Yeah, I hope they do it. They do more often than not. If I could add just one other point. So some of the comments that we heard also brought to my mind, if we think about kind of what we value in the profession, in a kind of what we valorize as indicators of, examples of lawyering at its best, very often it is those lawyers who do exactly what it is that we're talking about, right? You think about ACLU and Skokie, we talk about kind of the attorneys who stepped up to represent detainees at Gitmo, not obviously a sympathetic bunch. We in some sense recognize that these lawyers were stepping up to do something significant. So maybe one way to think about how we recover this in our profession is by reminding people of that, reminding our students, reminding those in practice that is lawyering at its best. When it's not, I'm not representing someone because I agree with them. I might be representing them because neither I nor anyone else agrees with them, and that's the most critical moment for me to be willing to step up.
I've got some other questions. Anybody want to weigh in on that?
I do. You know, Professor Varkey, he can't get the same treatment from Big Law as the Gitmo detainees. I mean, think about that. And that's pretty tough. And just speaking of the lack of intellectual diversity, I mean, University of Texas Law School, do you guys know who the co-faculty sponsors are for the Federalist Society chapter at UT? It's me and Judge Ho, because there was no one else. There were no full-time faculty at all to be the FedSoc faculty sponsors. And so it's Judge Ho and me. And you know, that seems somewhat scary. We also don't know what we're doing in that regard. But where's everybody? Where is everybody?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to add something. So agree with what you had to say. I think there does have to be a space, though, for individual attorneys from a moral perspective to say,
that's right,
I can't represent that client just because morally, personally, I find that unacceptable. And that is okay. What I find particularly troubling about what some of these law students have done is saying, I find what that corporation does to be morally unacceptable, therefore that corporation shouldn't be able to get legal counsel, and therefore I'm going to shame their legal counsel to not represent them. Completely different problem.
I'd also say, I mean, there's a proud history you just referenced of lawyers taking on unpopular causes. You have a right as a lawyer to do that, but you don't have a right to be popular for doing that. And historically, most of the lawyers who did those types of things, say during the civil rights movement, were vilified, were at risk, you know, were threatened with violence, sometimes actually subjects of violence. So, you know, the tradition of taking on those unpopular clients might mean you're not everyone's favorite person at the cocktail party. You know, so what? If that's your values, you should live them. But I think the idea that, you know, you can take on unpopular clients and not suffer any, you know, ostracism. I mean, our my old court, the Fifth Circuit, even the judges during the civil rights movement who were heroic suffered, you know, great personal cost for doing so.
Well, I've got to get to Justice Blacklock because he's going to carry our ethics discussion here in a minute for the credit. But let me just follow up with you. Judge Costa, because you mentioned the civil rights lawyers who participated in that, judges on the circuit who participated in that. And this is a question I had originally planned for Mr. Smart, but students at a law school, several law schools a few years ago boycotted Paul Weiss because Paul Weiss represented Exxon in climate change litigation. Are law firms set up today structurally to take on these unpopular clients? Mr. Sasser says perhaps in some instances, but they're drawing the line. Law firms as a whole are drawing the lines. It's not, as Mr. Smart says, there's someone in the law firm who is personally, morally offended, and so we shouldn't force that person to do it. But you mentioned the civil rights workers. Mr. Sasser mentioned the professor who believes that there are two genders. Gitmo workers. Their ABA has death penalty links on its webpage. They have Gitmo links on their webpage. Where are the big firms with the January 6th kind of defendants and the Seditious Act? There's none of that. Why do you think that is? Is it okay, Gitmo, if you're going to take it down through airplanes, but these people are unworthy of big firm coordination?
All right. Well, first, I mean, on the climate change, which, as you've mentioned, has really been the main focus of student protest of law firms. I mean, lawyers at big firms are crawling all over each other to get that work. I mean, that has not impacted at all law firms. Like Paul Weiss represents Exxon. We represent Chevron in that work. So I think on those type issues, I don't think there is an impact. Maybe on what you'd call more, you know, the social issues. Certainly, I think some firms are going to be reluctant to take that on. I mean, I think one of the great things, one of the reasons I went to our firm is we have a lot of ideological diversity that extends to the types of matters people take on a pro bono basis. We've done work, I know people here have done work at our firm, have done work with you. But I don't think that's necessarily representative. But you know, I think my concern would be if law firms are taking on one viewpoint of an issue and not the other, which is happening on occasions. I also understand why some firms, though, and I think fairly would just say, I think there were comments earlier today, corporations should stay out of these politically highly charged issues. So I think law firms might legitimately say, look, we've got lawyers with all different types of views. We don't want to take either side on a high profile issue that's going to disturb people's conscience. I mean, right, I think this organization is a big believer also in people's right to have their in terms of speech and religion, have their conscience, you know, work consistent with their conscience. And, you know, you mentioned the Gitmo cases. I mean, I remember when that was always happening at a lot of big law firms. I personally would have had no desire to represent those people. You know, there's a right to a lawyer. There's not a right to have me as your lawyer. And I think each lawyer is going to make those choices based on their own conscience. But I think the difference is I still could respect the fact that others chose to represent those Gitmo detainees. And I think that's the concern, is that we're losing that ability to say, look, I wouldn't do that myself. That's not something I'm comfortable doing. But we recognize generally there's a need for that representation. So, no, I do think on some of the areas you raised, you're probably not going to see law firms taking on that kind of work. But I do think that is in my return to practice from a year, I mean, the dollar is still almighty. I think I disagree with some of what I heard earlier about a lot of what corporations or firms are doing isn't profit maximizing. These are profit maximizing places. They might be making wrong decisions about, oh, if we need to take on this woke marketing campaign. And that might end up being a miscalculation, just like Ford rolls out a car like the Edsel that's not a successful car. But I think these decisions are being made to maximize profits. And there's a concern, unfortunately, just given the dynamics, that certain positions are going to make firms, A, unpopular to clients, B, unpopular to the law students they're trying to recruit.
And chasing the dollar, Mr. Smart, let me loop you back in here, because everybody's chasing the dollars from your company. And so what can your company or companies like yours do to encourage law firms like Judge Costa's to take on unpopular clients and unpopular ideas? Because you never know when WTW is going to be the new Exxon, and law students on Twitter are going to arrange boycotts for anybody who dares represent your company.
Yeah. Well, we are a client of Gibson Dunn, so. But one thought in response is that I agree with you. I think, you know, it depends on the corporation, how they make money, as to how they might approach the market. But something particularly within the last few years that I've seen quite a bit of, which is, to me, was surprising, is that it seems like every time something bad happens in the world, there's some sort of social ill, corporations feel like they have to get out in front of that and send out mass emails to all their employees to address that. And often they tend to lean left. It sort of gets to the wokeism that I guess we're experiencing more broadly. And sometimes perhaps, you know, it just depends on what has happened, right? But I don't think there's too much of that. And corporations don't exist to solve all of the world's ills. They exist to make money. And some corporations, by going woke, will make money. Others won't. But to answer your question on... I think corporations, like we talk about the rule of law, and I think this concept of being able to engage your own counsel without, you know, them being shamed for representing you, and how our system works. I think of Paul Clement and what happened to him. Now, I recognize that King and Spalding is a sponsor, so I want to highlight again that I do believe in redemption.
At the table, say. Right. you're good. I'll look out.
But I think Paul said it best, and this is an article from Politico from 2011, and it quotes the letter that he wrote to the then chairman of King and Spalding, and he says, I resign out of the firmly held belief that a representation should not be abandoned because the client's legal position is extremely unpopular in certain quarters. Defending unpopular clients is what lawyers do, which was what we've been discussing. He goes on to say, I recognize from the outset that this statute, speaking, of course, of the Defense of Marriage Act and, you know, his clients of the House of Representatives, I recognize from the outset that this statute implicates very sensitive issues that prompt strong views on both sides. But having undertaken the representation, I believe there's no honorable course for me but to complete it. So what I can say is that, thankfully, a previous boss of mine hired Paul Clement. We had a case pending before the United States Supreme Court, and we used him. Why did we use him? Because he's really good at what he does, and he's principled. And so that's how I think corporations can make a statement. You hire the attorney that you think is going to win the case for you. You look for the person who's the best. And again, on this idea, it's really fundamental to the practice of law. You can't silence your opposition. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. So. Justice Blacklock, I'm sorry for getting off script here, but I do want to get back to you, and I hope you'll feel comfortable about commenting on anything we've talked about, from your flip phone to legal academia to corporations. But let me just preface all of whatever you want to talk to with this question, and that is, you are a member of the Texas Supreme Court, and the Texas Supreme Court regulates the lawyers who practice in Texas, and they're in charge of ensuring that those who do have integrity, and you are in charge, the body you work for is in charge of preserving that for representation now and into the future. Do you see disruptions from student protesters or other lawyers as a persistent ethical failure, or do you just see it as they're too young to know better, and that they'll, once they're mugged by reality, they'll become less fragile. Address anything you want to address.
Well, I think in general that this disruption fad is a childish phenomenon and needs to be dealt with the way grown-ups deal with childish misbehavior, which is lovingly but sternly. But with respect to the ethics question, the court has received some input. Senator Cruz actually may have sort of tipped off this conversation, but we received input from various sources, you know, suggesting that these displays, like what we saw with Judge Duncan and others, are perhaps something that the Board of Law Examiners should think about in its character and fitness examination of applicants for admission to the Texas bar. And the court takes that suggestion very seriously and has asked the Board of Law Examiners to look at, you know, what that might look like. We certainly would absolutely never have any kind of even remotely, you know, ideological test for bar admission or you know, discourage or diminish anybody's our sense of anybody's character and fitness for bar admission based on the causes with which they've associated themselves. But the sort of aggressive hostility to opposing views and to people's right to counsel or people's right to just stand up and speak things that are well within the mainstream of the public discourse does, I think, raise questions that the Board of Law Examiners might want to look at in terms of the character, the demonstrated hostility to free inquiry and free speech is, I think, a legitimate inquiry in terms of a character and fitness examination for admission to the bar. This is all, you know, being explored and thought about and hasn't been sort of formalized as a new policy of the Board of Law Examiners, but it's in the works and the court is looking at it very closely.
Were there any other topics that I didn't give you time to talk on that you wanted to? Because I have two other points, if not.
If I have a minute, I'll say, you know, I mentioned that this is a new phenomenon, or certainly seems very new to me. And you could take that as sort of a black pill, like we're headed in the wrong direction, or a black lock pill, as my clerks like to say. I don't think it's that. I think it's the fact that it's new and novel doesn't mean that we're irretrievably headed in the wrong direction. Take it as a white pill that this is an aberration. This is a strange moment in the history of our country, in the history of our public discourse and the way we relate to each other when we talk about things that matter. There is a deep, deep well of support in the history and traditions of our country and among the people broadly of our country. I'm not talking about law students, I'm talking about the American people. The deep, deep support culturally for free speech and freedom of inquiry and listening to other people. And that tradition is very deep and very strong. It has taken a hit recently in many quarters, but I think the great weight of sentiment in our country is still firmly on the side of people's right in all kinds of settings to stand up and say what they believe. And what we need to do is make sure that we don't allow, in whatever way, wherever we have influence, that we try not to allow this moment to accelerate us down a path to where we lose those traditions that are part of what have made our country so great.
Justice Blacklock, if I could follow up with another point or another question to you, and that is judges, state or federal judges, are to be neutral and objective. And what is your take on law students who protest judges? Now, understand, and we were at the dinner where Judge Hoke talked about this, judges should not expect to be immune from being protested. But what about law school protesters, student protesters who come and protest a judge for their legal analysis? Do you think that potentially undermines the perception that judges are going to be neutral and objective, and that they may that this may be an avenue to get them to change their analysis?
In terms of the interaction with judicial neutrality and objectivity, I think this may not be a cause, it's an effect, right? I mean, the students, I think, have been led to believe, perhaps, you know, in error by some people at law schools, that judges are essentially political actors. And so the students have a mindset that if the judge does something that satisfies me politically, that's good. And if I don't like the outcome, that's bad. And so the thinking is entirely outcome driven and has nothing to do with legal reasoning. The judiciary, I think, is not without blame for the extent to which people have that view of us. It's not that it's all our fault, but there is blame to go around. And I think students, the students involved in these episodes clearly have that view of what judges are and what they do, and it's incumbent upon all of us to disabuse them of that. In my experience as a judge, that is, you know, not at all what goes on, irrespective of the ideological valence of, that the person may bring to the table.
Is there concern at your level and at Judge Costa's former level on the circuit and on the Supreme Court, is there concern about some law schools allowing the students to declare some topics off limits that can't be discussed? Will either shout you down or will intimidate the faculty and staff so that they make it impossible to bring in speakers? Is there some concern that those students will come out into the real world and lack the intellectual diversity that the dean says that they need to take on? That is, they need to be able to argue both sides of a legal issue, regardless of their personal beliefs. 25 years ago, Randy Barnett would have talked at a conference like that and talked about interstate commerce and can you force people to eat broccoli? And the Federalist Society would have debated it and come to a come to their own views on it. But you would go to a liberal institution or speaker, and they just laugh at you. That's a ridiculous concept. Nobody would consider that. And then a few years ago in the ACA cases, there are Supreme Court justices acting for it. So are you concerned from your level, Judge Costa, when you were on the circuit, or maybe even now when you're hiring new lawyers, are you concerned that some of these schools who have this reputation are producing lawyers who may not be able to do that?
It's a big concern, obviously, and that's why we're here. And I just want to reiterate that if, all of us up here, we may have influence in our various spheres. I mean, particularly as a dean of a law school, and I think Texas A&M is a place where I have been welcomed and experienced a fine atmosphere in terms of intellectual diversity and openness to ideas. So I want to mention that with respect to A&M, but. Yeah, it's an enormous problem. That's why we're here. You may feel like we have influence, you know, the court and the dean and these things, and what can you do? Hiram mentioned this a little bit. What you can do is stand for the truth in whatever capacity you can. And if you face trials because of it, consider those trials pure joy, as I said. Stand for the truth. Do it boldly. You won't just be speaking the truth, which is good in itself, you'll be helping us turn this around and get the political climate in our country back to a place where we value each other's ideas and value each other's right to free speech.
Judge Costa, is this an illusory concern, or is there something to it, or do you have any concerns?
Sure. No, I remember a few years back, I read a story where a criminal law professor had stopped teaching, you know, the whole chapter on sexual crimes, rape, sexual and other assaults, because of, and you know, I don't know how widespread that is, but you certainly hear examples of that. And to me, look, and obviously that's a very difficult area for some people to listen to if they've been victims themselves. But if you can't even listen to it in a law school classroom and discuss it and have that back and forth, how are you going to actually represent or prosecute people involved in those kind of cases? I mean, lawyers deal with bad situations. People don't call a lawyer up when something good has happened. So if you're not, you know, equipped in the academic setting to dealing with uncomfortable, difficult, upsetting situations, how in the world are you going to be able to do it in real life when that person is sitting right next to you? So it is a concern. And, you know, it's something to think about in hiring. I only hired one law clerk from your alma mater.
How did it work
and
out?
She was great. She was great. And I, you know,
Judge Ho's role before Judge Ho.
Right, right. But I really like to hire from University of Chicago because I think that is a school that
Which
has done
is
a
Judge
better
Ho's
job.
Role as well.
Exactly. I was texting with Judge Ho this morning. We're good friends. But I thought Chicago has done a better job than most of the quote elite law schools of maintaining that back and forth when both sides have a seat at the table and can give. So I think it's something to think about. And again, you want students who've been in that cauldron and if they're going to deal with the much more difficult situation of fighting it out in court and dealing with uncomfortable cases.
So. Just quick two comments. The first on the criminal law one Judge Costa mentioned. So it was probably about 10 years ago that it pretty widely, I mean, it was not one or two professors. Yeah. It kind of spread nationwide that, maybe we shouldn't teach rape in the criminal law classes. But I'll give credit that almost, not instantly, but pretty quickly, there was a significant pushback, including from faculty who had no conservative or whatever the politics would be on that, that said, how are we doing our job if we are not teaching? And they were sensitive to the sensitivity that you acknowledge, Judge Costa, of someone who's been a victim of sexual assault, but they said, but we have to still do it because that's part of our educational mission. And then to the question that you were asking, Judge Blacklock, about the character and fitness piece of it, I will say at the Trope banquet, the only part that made me nervous about Judge Ho's remarks was that, and only in this sense, we should be nervous or have some pause about the risk of putting in place structures that potentially become additional vehicles to penalize unpopular views, right? Because once that's in place, I worry, or what could be perceived as, and that's obviously not the structure that we're talking about, but my worry is that the lines may get blurry there, and so we should be careful about, and again, I understand the youthful indiscretion can't be an answer to everything, but I would be nervous about regulating entry into the profession too rigidly based on these things, because there's a real risk that once that gun is on the table, right, it can be used in all sorts of ways, and for a group that will oftentimes, per this conversation, have views that may be unpopular, that makes me nervous as a tool. So I think it has a place in the extreme cases, but I think we should also be cautious about it.
Very good, thank you. And I'm sorry, we are out of time, but this was such a good panel. The time flew by. Take that, Judge Eskridge.